he loomed pretty large over my family history. That Medal of Honor you mentioned hung on a wall in every home that I ever grew up in, because my mother was his oldest child, so she received that medal. But what's kind of interesting is he was just sort of a vague legend, and everybody in the family was very proud of him, but very, very little detail. So the truth is, I didn't know very much anything, and I sort of assumed, well, maybe my mom and my auntie knew, cousins, whatever, but the truth is, we didn't know very much about him. We were sort of content to let him be a plaster saint, if you will.
And what then piqued your interest in terms of uncovering more about this story and really opening up a lot of issues that, you know, very often in families they prefer to keep closed?
Yeah, you know, the truth is I'm a bit embarrassed. I've been a journalist for, you know, 3+ decades, and I wish this had occurred to me a much longer time ago, because obviously by the time I got around to it, a lot of the men who fought in this Battle of Tarawa, which was 1943, were dead. A lot of my relatives were dead who had known my grandfather. What really piqued my interest is in very late 2009, my auntie, his youngest daughter, sent me an email link to a story about the fact that there's a federal government agency out of Hawaii called the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency now. At the time, it had a different name, but they had been ordered by Congress to go back to this tiny, tiny atoll called Tarawa to search for the missing remains of a bunch of Marines who had been buried there and never recovered after the war, which was something that, as I learned in my research, my family should have known, perhaps, but we really didn't know that. And so it was kind of a historical mystery that this had all been swept under the rug. And that was really at the point, I mean, that I said, gee, I'd like to learn more. And literally 9 months later, I was down in Tarawa when that agency did its first explorations in August and September 2010. As it turned out, that agency would not really be the way to find these guys, and it wouldn't be my end of involvement with them, really. So I found a nonprofit group that with a lot fewer resources was doing a lot better work.
And that's History Flight?
History Flight Inc., yeah, out of the Florida Keys. It's one guy, wasn't in the military, wasn't a Marine. He just acted like a Marine, sort of like a bulldog. He found out about this in 2007. He thought it was a historical injustice. You know, these people had lost family members and then had been given every excuse in the book and lied to, really, by the government about what happened to their remains. And he grabbed hold of it like a bulldog. His name is Mark Noah, and he has never let go to this day. He's had incredible success on a shoestring budget, hiring top-notch archaeologists and surveyors and everybody. And I consider myself part of the organization. I'm a volunteer, and we're still down there recovering guys right now.
What was the story about your grandfather's death, that the official story that your family had been told?
Well, thankfully, my family, the Bonnieman family, are inveterate letter writers and savers. And my great-grandfather, so his father, also had a fleet of secretaries. He had a coal company, and he did everything in, like, not triplicate, but like quintuplet. So I've got all these letters. And what I was able to piece together was, this was a huge tragedy. My grandfather he did not have to go to war at all. He was 31 years old. He had children. He was married. He owned a copper mine, which was critical to the defense of the United States in the war. But he was sort of, I assume he was maybe ADHD, not a guy who liked to sit around. So when he joined, he decided to go to the Marines in the front lines, which is crazy. He could have had any job he wanted. Very privileged family. So they were shattered when he was killed. It just absolutely destroyed people. And they really, really wanted to get his body back. So I've got this letter trail beginning just maybe 2 weeks after he was killed. My great-grandfather began writing letters saying, we want to find, you know, please tell us where he is. How can we arrange to bring him back to Knoxville, Tennessee, where that family was from? And over the years, he just got more and more discouraged because he was given all these different excuses. You know, well, most of the bodies were buried at sea, the implication being that's what happened to my grandfather. Well, he was probably buried as an unknown in the punch bowl, the National Museum of the, or National Cemetery of the Pacific in Hawaii, as an unknown. All these different excuses. And, you know, he died in 1953, absolutely not knowing. So his remaining son, my my grandfather's younger brother sort of took up that battle. He continued for decades after. And then my mom even did a little bit of it. So we just got story after story after story. And, you know, that I don't fault them. They didn't have the technology for not being able to find the remains. This island is tiny. What I've learned of archaeology working with History Flight these last 8 years, if you miss by an inch, you've missed by 10,000 miles. So it's tough. I do fault the government for lying to families and pretending that, you know, something had happened and that didn't.
And what actually did happen then? And compared that to what you were told.
So this battle took 76 brutal, bloody hours. 1,100 Americans killed, 5,000 Japanese forces. So 6,000 people on 1 square kilometer of sand dead in just a little over 3 days. Brutal. Awful. No time to bury anybody until it was all over. So burials had to be hasty. They got Navy construction battalions to bulldoze out trenches, and they did lay the American forces in. They did try to record where they were. They'll take a dog tag and hang it on a stick or something. But the fact is, the war was still on, and they needed to rebuild that airfield. Jeeps going through, you know, bulldozers and so forth. And basically, those markers were knocked down and so forth. So Army Graves Registration, which was the government agency tasked with this after the war, went back, 1946, and basically recovered about half of those 1,100. Well, about 100 to 200 were probably actually buried at sea. So whatever was left, they got about half. And then by 49 and 50, they were declaring that all the rest were unrecoverable. That is what they said about my grandfather. And it just sort of got swept under the rug. I mean, so this island today, exceedingly poor, one of the most crowded places in the Western Hemisphere. About 25,000 people live on 1 square kilometer of sand. Very poor, really great, wonderful people. But they live in shanties. They're covered the island. It's an incredibly difficult environment to do this work because you got to dig big holes everywhere. So my theory, I don't have this exactly confirmed, is that U.S. government agencies just weren't all that excited about going and trying to work in this very difficult environment. And they didn't pay any attention until, thanks to Mark Noah, but also a man named Bill Niven, who happened to be doing the similar kind of research right at the same time back in the 2000s, Congress got involved and ordered this agency to go down there and start looking. The truth is, my estimation, and I think it's a fair one, and I did a bunch of Freedom of Information requests and got emails and so forth, I just don't think the agency, which has a $300 million a year budget, was very interested. Who was interested is this man, Mark Noah. And I've just never met sort of a more stubborn force of nature, you know? I mean, he's a very decent guy, but he doesn't put up with any BS. And he latched onto this, and he's been incredibly successful. Our organization has, I don't know the exact count, but by now I think we've got this. The agency in Hawaii is the only one legally tasked with identifying battlefield remains. But we do all the rest of the work. We do all our own identifications when we can. We do DNA. We do dental matches. Then, to be official, they go to Hawaii and they do that. And I think we're coming up on about 100, I don't know, certainly more than 80 remains that we have recovered, all doing our work. These are guys that were just lost to history, and they've been identified and come back and been buried by their families.
And what does that mean? Say, for your particular family, what is the impact having more information? Because your grandfather is still dead and he still died.
That's right.
Brutally in a war.
Yeah.
But the story has changed a bit. So what impact has that had?
Yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, you know, if you're asking about me, I was a bit skeptical to start with. I mean, I sit around and I think, well, you know, this agency, we're going to spend hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to bring back remains. And obviously, those people are dead and they don't care. But here's what I've learned. I've talked to an awful lot of families on behalf of History Flight, calling them about DNA samples. We can't ever call a family and say, hey, we found your person. That has to be done by the agency. But we can say, hey, would you help us out? It's very powerful, meaningful. Most of these guys were very young. So what we are talking about are remote cousins, nieces, nephews. And my grandfather's case was highly unusual because he actually had children and they're still living, two of them, and then there's grandchildren. I was a little skeptical, but once I got involved and I understood how powerful it was for all these other families, I was like, you know, great. And Mark, Noah, and History Flight, I mean, literally this work of finding, you know, what, however many, 80 to 100 at this point that have been identified, on $6 to $8 million, privately raised funds. Now, History Flight does contract now with this agency, which is great, good cooperative relationship, but that's amazing when you consider $300 million being spent by this military agency. And, you know, they've literally on their own, without assistance from either History Flight or somebody else, found one. So as far as my mom went, she's still living right here in Boulder, Colorado. She's doing great. She lives out in Gun Barrel. She was not thrilled about this when I started.
See, that's what I'm curious about, mm-hmm. is that I think when a family has a narrative about somebody, and then that narrative becomes so entrenched in the family lore and history and people's own sense of identity, when that changes, even if it could be one or two or three generations removed, it fundamentally changes people's identity.
Yeah.
And what was your mom's reticence about this?
You know, my mom was 7 years old and alone of her sisters. So there were three little girls. She was the only one old enough to remember him. And it was always very painful. And I don't want to give this away, but I want, you know, one of the themes of this book, and I'm very pleased that people are picking up on this, is war may be necessary sometimes, but as Hemingway said, it's always a crime and it always shatters families. And, you know, we can run around and tie ribbons around trees and yay hero and clap in airports and so forth. But there's a great quote from a guy named David Colley, a historian in here, who say, it destroys families. Or it shatters them, or it affects them. And in the case of my mom's family, it really did kind of destroy. I mean, the impacts and the things that were not my grandfather's fault, he wasn't there, that happened to them after were absolutely horrific. So my mom was never that excited. She was the designated spokesperson as the oldest survivor. Every 10 years, the reporters come around, hey, it's the Tarawa anniversary. And she'd do her duty, but she finally kicked that off to her younger sister because it was painful. She just didn't. She literally and figuratively was very skeptical about digging up. But she did say over time, well, if people are going to do this, I suppose it would be nice if they found my father because of my grandparents. And honestly, I've given all these talks, and you know, when we buried him, I was asked to speak publicly several times and so forth. That's what I think about, because I've read all their letters and the pain that it caused. I'm not a religious person. I'm not a woo person, so I don't think my great-grandparents, just personally, I don't think they're smiling down on me, you know. But I just sort of feel like I was closing a circle. The only other thing I want to say is that in doing my excavations, I was privileged to help History Flight do the physical excavations, but I'm just a grunt and a videographer and a photographer. My excavations into my grandfather's story, which, you know, really portray him as the real man he was, not the plaster saint. Interviewing family members, particularly the descendants of his younger brother, there was a lot that they did know that they just didn't talk about. You know, I mean, just it was just sort of hushed up, and we were all pretty content to, as I say in the book, kind of put him in a shining suit of armor and on a white charger and behind glass. And who wouldn't? And you know what? I'm not big on the word hero, to tell you the truth. I think there are people who do heroic things. I don't love the idea of this person is a hero, because we're all humans. And my grandfather was intensely human and remarkable and still one of my most admired people. But I loved being able to write about him and humanize him in this book. And it was a big reason that I wrote it. I was a little worried about what relatives would think. But so my mom loves the book. That makes me happy.
Well, it's a fascinating read about the history of World War II, about this whole process of repatriating remains, because you brought your grandfather back.
Correct.
And he was buried with his parents in Knoxville.
That's right. Right next to his parents, two sisters and brother. And that is, you read these letters, it's very heartbreaking. You know, these aging people, and they lost their beloved son, and they desperately wanted him to come back. And so there was some vindication there, you know, and it was really nice to be able to do that, as opposed to, there were people said, well, why didn't you have him buried in Arlington, where, you know, the public could come? And the public came to our funeral too. Here's an interesting thing. He was considered enough of a, you know, important person that 8th and I, the Marine unit that does the Arlington burials, and they don't do this ever. got on buses, came to Knoxville to do that funeral. So it's been a really great process, and it's fun to have the book done.
Well, Clay Bonnyman Evans will speak about Bones of My Grandfather, Reclaiming a Lost Hero of World War II at the Boulder Bookstore Wednesday evening at 7:30. And on Thursday evening, he'll be at the Tattered Cover on Colfax in Denver. That's at 7. He has a website as well, and we'll put a link to that. And thank you very much, Clay.
Great. And can I just mention also, if you can't make those signings, July 26th at the Old Firehouse Bookstore, Old Firehouse Books up in Fort Collins.
Clay Bonnyman Evans, thank you very much.
Thanks, Maeve.